Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
All right, garage doors up.
Motor Talk with Toby Hagen.
Toby, good evening to you. Welcome back.
Thanks, Phil. Good evening.
Great to have you with us too. I'm glad we were able to do the program. It's getting increasingly difficult, I must say, to everyone trying to broadcast and present and do programs with all of the lockdowns that we have. But anyway, through the technology, Toby had a few wires and batteries in the back of his car, and we've got and we've jerry-rigged something up here in the garage, so hopefully it all works for us. Anyway, sales figures for June, Toby. Again, sales pretty strong. If you can find a car to buy, there's still shortages around, aren't there?
Yeah, absolutely. There are shortages, 100%. But you're right, a super strong month. And actually almost exactly the same number of sales as June in last year. But if you look at the first 6 months of the year, that's where it's obviously a huge difference. Obviously, a fair few months of that first 6 months last year was taken out with lockdowns and so on. So sales up 28% for the first half of this year. And some of the big changes in the market, utes just show no sign of stopping. Utes now make up 20.6% of the market. So yeah, more than one in five new vehicle sales is a ute, which is just astonishing.
Yeah.
And some big winners in this. Some of the Chinese brands, GWM up 238%, MG up 220%, LDV up 64%, and then some of the other brands as well. Isuzu had a huge month. Kia, interestingly, Kia is actually outselling Hyundai now, which always used to be the other way around. But yeah, for a few months of this year, we've seen Kia ahead of Hyundai. Now, part of that is down a little bit to stock shortages and so on. Mazda bouncing back, but there were some losers. And funnily enough, when you start, we've talked a bit about in the last few years some of the massive growth in terms of luxury vehicle sales. And quite a few of those came off in June. So Audi, for example, down 21%, BMW down 7%, Mercedes-Benz down 25%, Porsche down 21%. So it's been a tough month for some of those luxury brands. Top seller, probably no surprise, Toyota Hilux again.
Mm-hmm.
But funnily enough, the Toyota Prado actually outsold the Toyota Corolla, which I think sort of shows how we're thinking these days. The four-wheel drive and ute sales are just soaring at the moment because so many people are dreaming of travelling around the country, hitching up a caravan and maybe adventuring. And so, yeah, for a Prado to outsell a Corolla is pretty astonishing. Mm. So, yeah, some big movers during the month.
Yes, exactly. And to indicate just how popular utes are, how about this figure? Ford sales in Australia, 72% of the Ford cars sold are the Ranger Ute.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Amazing, isn't it? I mean, when you think back to the days of the Falcon and so on, it's a big change, isn't it?
Oh, it is. And this is something Ford always used to argue that, or Ford always used to defend, saying, you know, we're not the Falcon car company, we've got other cars. And
yeah,
I remember in the early 2000s, they used to, you know, when they were trying to cement the Focus, if you remember, they changed the Focus nameplate. And they sort of said, oh, look, we haven't got a good history in small cars. And I used to point out to them, well, in the 1980s, you used to sell a lot of Lasers, little Ford Lasers that were built in Australia. But, yeah, I mean, they cannot get some of their models to fire. So the Escape, for example, still struggles. That's their mid-sized SUV in the sweet spot of the market. They really, really struggle to sell those. Fiesta's changed. That's fairly different. But Focus, they can't get Focus. They've shelved the Mondeo. A couple of the success stories. They're still chipping away at the Everest. So while the Ford Everest doesn't beat the Prado on outright sales, it's still a pretty strong contender. And the Mustang just keeps ticking along, which is quite unusual for those sports cars. Often with sports cars, you see a big surge in the first year or two as everyone sort of fumbles to get onto the newcomer. And then it dies off after that. But Ford's done a really clever job of just keeping that Mustang ticking along. They sort of bring out, minor updates, and they'll bring out limited edition models and just try and tease people along and give them another excuse to consider it. So that one's been pretty successful.
I like what you said a couple of weeks ago. You said the trouble with these sorts of cars is that, you know, often when they're released, everyone who wants one buys one, and then that's it.
Yeah, that's right. That's absolutely right. I mean, and it is, they're fashion items. I mean, these sorts of cars are fashion items.
Yeah.
And every car maker always says that is the biggest challenge, is trying to keep it ticking over. I mean, and cars, they try to stretch them for at least a 6 or 7 year lifespan. Some cars, you know, Mazda MX-5, for example, will usually go longer, about 10 years, something like that. And they've just got to keep them, you know, keep trying to, as I said, tease people into a new model with something with a little bit more here, or it might just be something as simple as a new colour, or you know, some different coloured seats. Those sorts of things can make a difference as well. But Porsche does it very cleverly too. I mean, they've got the 911, that's their iconic model. There's more than 20 variants of that 911, and roughly every 3 months they're doing something to it. So it's maybe, here's the updated version of this or whatever. So they just keep rolling them out over the lifespan of the car, and it sort of works.
Poor old Holden didn't sell a single car in 2021. Well, nothing to sell. Is there anything to sell?
No, nothing to sell. But sometimes you see some stragglers kick in, like a dealer will have one left over and sell them. But first time since 1948 that a Holden hasn't been sold. So it's pretty sad.
Yep. All right. Just a few other bits of news before we take some calls. Lexus is getting rid of three of its passenger cars, including the IS sedan. That was once its biggest selling car, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was the second Lexus on sale in Australia. And yeah, absolutely. That was the car that sort of, you know, they had the LS, the big limousine, and then they bought out the IS, which was their volume car. But it's gone. They've come up against a new Australian design rule, which is pretty strict in regards to side impact and how the car performs in a side impact crash out up against a pole. And short story is those cars aren't going to meet the new regulations. So they've had to ditch them. Now, they're still here for another few months. I think it's November they're getting rid of them. But yeah, I mean, that's a huge shock. So Lexus, three of them, I think they've got 10 or 11 models on sale. Three of them are going.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them we sort of expected, the CT, the little hatchback, a Prius with a Lexus skin on it, and that one's gone. But look, they've got a couple of other things coming up as well. They've got a UX300E, so that'll be their first electric car, and indeed the first Lexus that you'll be able to recharge in Australia. So obviously Lexus has been big on hybrids, but they've all been the sort of regular hybrids, the non-plug-in hybrids. And if you look at what the rival luxury brands do, you know, almost all of them, all the way through to Porsche and so on, they've got a car that can be recharged in a power point and you know, at least partially electric. But Lexus hasn't had any electrified cars in Australia. They've only had the regular hybrids. So it's but that's all changing. As I said, in the next couple of months, we're also expecting the NX450H. So the new mid-sized SUV, that looks like it'll come out in a plug-in hybrid in Australia as well.
Yeah. This microchip shortage, Toby, which we hear about, I find this hard to believe. I find it hard to believe that there's a worldwide shortage of microchips, and it's causing problems in car manufacturing. In fact, so much so that General Motors has actually stopped putting wireless phone charging in some models, and they've previously stopped putting stop-start functions in some models as well because they don't have the chips for it. What's going on?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, the computer chips around the world are in short supply. Basically, consumer electronics have boomed over the last 12 or 18 months, and car makers at the same time started pulling back on their ordering. Obviously, they've tried to ramp it up since, but those consumer electronics are buying a lot of them. So unfortunately, a lot of the car makers have been left high and dry. So, as you say, General Motors, one of them, pulling out some of the features. They're not the first ones to have done that. Some other brands have also done that, where they look at the car and all the microchips in it, and they can be hundreds in a car, and they think, okay, what features, what little things can we pull out of that car just temporarily, maybe for 6 months or something, so that we can keep the production line rolling. And that's the problem. I mean, obviously, when it's missing one component, it can hold up the entire production line or have to stop the production line. So they're looking at ways, obviously, to keep the production line running and just to minimise it a bit. It's obviously a challenge. And then the marketing department says, hang on a minute, we're going backwards on this. So it's not ideal. But it shows you the lengths that the car makers are going to at the moment to try and get around what is hopefully a short-term issue, but one that's causing massive grief to a lot of brands around the world.
Yeah, all right. Volvo's going very hard on electric cars. The XC90, the seven-seater, is going to be all electric. The XC60 is also going to be full electric. That's due in, 3 years' time? They've dropped their diesel engines completely. So they're probably going harder than most.
Absolutely, they're going harder than most. And this is something, you've got brands like Jaguar, for example, saying by 2025 they'll be all electric as well. But no, Volvo absolutely is going very hard. And as you say, models like the XC60, which XC40 is their top seller, and then they've got XC60, the mid-sized SUV, and the XC90, the large SUV. Now, word is that some of those names might change once they do the electric models. And as you say, XC90, the electric one's due next year to be revealed globally. Whether it makes it to Australia next year, we're not quite sure yet. But that's their seven-seat SUV. I mean, it goes up against BMW X5 and Audi Q7 and so on. So it's got big shoes to fill. I mean, XC90 was one of the early luxury seven-seat SUVs to hit the market about 20-odd years ago now.
Hmm.
And the challenge for them is going to be obviously playing competitively in that price segment. You know, most of those cars sort of tend to start at around the $90,000 to $100,000 mark, most of its competitors. It's going to be a challenge to see if they can do a full electric one for a competitive price. And also they've got to fit all the batteries and so on in. But that's where it's different. When you're starting with an electric car, when you start the design from scratch, you're starting from nothing, you can position everything in the ideal location for the electric components. So you don't need a massive engine bay up front. You can electric motors are relatively small, but what you do have to do is hide a lot of batteries in the floor. So you've got to fit those batteries in somewhere in the floor. But it often allows the car makers to stretch out the wheelbase, so the distance between the front and the rear wheels, which then helps them get some more interior space for occupants and so on. And that's where you see some of the electric cars you get into, those ground up design ones. That's when you see some really clever packaging going on and the way they fit the seats and so on in there,
yeah.
And certainly storage as well. I mean, often you can use the underbonnet, for example, for storage as well. So it's, it'd be interesting to see how they go with it.
Speaking of car shortages, one of my texters says, Toby, I've been waiting on a new Toyota RAV4 for 5 months now. Yeah, well, that's pretty standard. Last week, Toyota sent me a carry bag as a gift with a postcard saying good things come to those who wait. I would have preferred a discount.
but I mean, look, good on them in a way for doing something, for acknowledging that it's unusual what they're going through. But yeah, RAV4 has been one of the ones that's been hit pretty hard. And, 6 months plus for the particularly the top end versions, so the Cruiser and so on, and also the hybrids. The hybrids are the hard ones to get at the moment as well. Mm. So, but as I said, I mean, this is a challenge for these mainstream brands that they've never really had to face. I mean, usually it works the other way around. The head office will send them a boatload of cars and say, do something with those. And often they've got them parked on grass somewhere and they're trying to work out how to offload them with discounts and incentives and so on. Now they've got the opposite issue. And some of them, it's a challenge for them how to manage customers. I mean, customers of a Ferrari or something, they're used to waiting for a car. They often have to put the order in 6 or 12 months in advance.
Mm.
But someone buying a RAV4 wouldn't expect that. They expect to get it within a few weeks.
Well, they expect to buy it that weekend, don't they?
Some of them, absolutely.
Have a look at Saturday morning, take delivery Sunday afternoon.
Absolutely.
All right. Marie says, thank God for the lack of microchips if it means no stop-start function. It's not popular with everyone, is it? Which new cars are not having that appalling function? I'll buy one immediately. I quite like it. Not everyone does like it, though, I know.
No, and look, I know a lot of, some of my colleagues get into cars and that's the first thing they turn off. They say, it's hopeless, turn it off.
Yeah.
I like to leave it on to see how good a job the car does. And certainly some of them do a very ordinary job of, they're pretty clumsy in terms of how they refire the car once you get on the throttle.
Hmm.
But some of them do a terrific job. And I find some of the luxury brands you expect it, but some of those European brands, with the bigger engines in particular, they just seem to do it really smoothly and it just fires straight back up. But certainly some of them can be pretty clunky. It's a bit ordinary. And certainly, the ones a decade or so ago are hopeless.
Yeah.
But they've got better.
All right, let's get to some calls. Harry from Goulburn on the text line. In your opinion, Toby, what's better, Ram 1500 or the Chevy Silverado?
Well, there's actually a new Ram 1500 out. The previous one, the model code was DS, the new one's DT. I haven't driven that DT one yet, so I haven't driven the updated version. And look, they're horses for courses of what I remember of the previous Ram 1500, which you can still buy. You can still buy that older version of it at the more affordable end of the scale. I just remember that the Ram in the base model version, it felt very base model, even though it was an $80,000 car. or ute, or truck as they call them, it still had a very small infotainment screen. It was very basic inside. There wasn't a whole lot of attention to detail. It was more about, look at the size. It's got a big V8 engine. You could get a diesel later on. I haven't driven the diesel one, but the V8 was the push back then. So the Silverado I drove, it was enormous. And I seem to remember the Silverado being a more imposing vehicle, but the one I drove was much more expensive than the Ram. So I wouldn't feel comfortable recommending one over the other, particularly, as I said, that I haven't driven that new version of it.
Sure. They're a big ticket item, that's for sure. All right, Graham's been waiting on. Hello, Graham. Hi.
How are you, Toby? Around about 2018, Toyota changed the 6-speed gearbox in their Camry in the United States to an 8-speed gearbox. Mm-hmm. And from what I've read on the internet, they seem to have a few problems with it. The 2021 Camry has just been released in Australia with an 8-speed gearbox. Do you know if they've rectified any problems they might have had with the earlier ones over there?
I don't, is the short story. It's not the first time. Often when a new car comes out, you can have some teething problems like that, and Toyota's had that in the past with Land Cruiser, the current 200 series that is about to be about to go off sale. When that car first came out, it had some issues with excessive oil use on the V8 twin turbo diesel engine. But they worked that out fairly quickly, and I'd be stunned if 3 years later from when they first started having those issues, if they hadn't worked them out. But the short story is I'm not aware of the details in terms of what they've done, if anything, from an engineering perspective to try and address that. But as I said, in the past, Toyota's tended to do a reasonable job of addressing things if they've popped up.
Mm. So yep. You shouldn't have any worries buying one in Australia now?
I wouldn't have thought so, no. I think, again, the issues they've tended to have been sorted out fairly quickly. And Toyota understands that a lot of its reputation has been built on reliability and longevity and people not having to worry about major issues. That said, they do have issues kicking along. And obviously, people in Hiluxes and Fortunas and so on, with diesel particulate filters, have certainly a lot of people have experienced some angst with those, with failures and issues with them. But they've addressed them, albeit you could argue a little bit too late. They have addressed them since then, but no. So I wouldn't have an issue. I wouldn't have an issue diving into one. No.
Okay, thanks, Graham. Brad's on the line. Brad wants to go high end. Brad, g'day.
G'day, mate. How you going?
Not bad. You want to buy a big Lambo?
Perhaps. I'm just testing the water.
Okay.
That's all right. So, to give you a backstory, potentially, about 2 years back, I was looking at Galeros. They're kind of like the Kingswood of Lamborghinis. They're fairly basic. And they were going for around about the 90-100 grand mark in Australia. Yeah. And I've just noticed of late that they've sort of they're up to about 150, 160 grand. And I'm actually kicking myself thinking maybe I should have just done that on my bucket list. And I'm just wondering your opinion on it, mate.
Which Lamborghini was it?
Galera. Or Gallardo. Oh, or whatever.
Yeah. Gallardo. Yeah, Gallardo.
They're fairly basic Lamborghini.
Well, yes and no, they were basic. So that was, I'm pretty sure, I'm just trying to think, it was... So the new one of those is called the Huracan. The replacement vehicle for it is the Huracan. And the Gallardo or Gallardo, as we would say, is it was a bit of a game changer for Lamborghini in terms of what it did with volumes and so on. Obviously still low volume, but much bigger volume than a lot of their V12 engines and so on. So, look, it was a terrific car. It was fairly tight in the cabin. I always struggled with it inside in terms of trying to tilt my head to the side.
Yeah, they look a little small.
They are a little small. It's a good way to put it. It's certainly tight. But look, terrific engine. That V10 engine is just superb. It is a really Absolutely. Nice engine. Yeah. And what you often find with some of those cars, well, it happens across the board with Ferraris and Porsches and so on, is, they'll go through a depreciation schedule up to, maybe 8, 10 years old. And then the good ones will potentially start to appreciate after that, if they're in good condition, if they've been looked after, and that's crucial with these cars.
Absolutely, yes.
So look, obviously you're going in eyes wide open with a car like that. There's a lot that could potentially go wrong, and how it has been treated is absolutely crucial. Yeah. But the car itself was a great fun car. I mean, obviously, as I said, wildly impractical and used a lot of fuel and makes a lot of noise and turns heads.
I'm generally punching above my weight here.
Come on, Brad. Come on. Live large, Brad.
Yeah. But it's interesting. I mean, you wouldn't have got a Ferrari coming down that much. So Ferraris wouldn't drop in value to that perspective. Ferrari in Australia in particular, they monitor their resale values pretty carefully, and they're careful in terms of how many vehicles they import to try and look after the resale values of the current cars as well. So, bang for buck, you're probably going to get a bit, but you're buying a car that has potential issues. Hmm.
Sorry, Brad. Start again, Brad.
Yeah, what I was trying to determine is, like, I was looking at these motor vehicles, that particular model, that Glaro type thing, and I noticed, like, 2 years back, I was looking at them, a little bit more than 2 years back, where I could pick one up for around about the $90,000 mark, and I've seen that they've increased to around about the $150,000 mark. I mean, where does that stand now, type thing? Is that motor
vehicle? Where's it going to end up?
Oh, you wanted how much they're worth. Okay.
Mm. You mean you're wondering what they're going to be worth in 5 or 10 years?
Well, potentially, even back then I was looking at them and people saying this is a great investment, sit on it for a year and I have a fun car for a year. Cross it off the bucket list, if that makes any sense. I don't know.
Those cars, so in times of, so during the GFC, for example, a lot of those top-end cars that, let's face it, they're a toy, no one needs them, a lot of them struggled in terms of values. So their prices come off and they can be impacted pretty heavily by that sort of thing, by outside or by external economic forces, whereas, you know, something like a mid-sized SUV is unlikely to be hit nearly as hard. So in terms of, you know, what's going to happen to those vehicles over the next few years, no one knows. I mean, you know, it's like asking an economist what's going to happen with the economy over the next few years. You'll get 10 different responses from 10 different economists. So,
That's right.
It'll be the same with a car like that. And I think, you know, no one forecast that a lot of the collectible cars in the world would be increasing in value to the point that they had. And I've heard a lot of people saying this has to stop and the bubble's got to burst shortly. It hasn't yet, but you know, it may well do, or it might keep bubbling along. And I'd hate to try and guess one way or another because it's
exactly too open forecast. Exactly. Thanks, Brad. Richard, hello, Electric Mini.
Yeah, g'day, Phil, Toby. Mate, listen, my own personal car's a red line, but I'm starting to feel guilty because, you know, big V8. So I'm thinking, I've got a Cooper S, so I started looking at a Mini, replacing that, and I noticed the Electric Mini down in Hobart, which is where I'm from. But how good are they? And to be honest, they're about $70,000with the looking at the options and everything. And I mean, I think from memory, you can get a bloody one of those ones, those electric Teslas. So how do they compare with a Tesla for about the same money? That's my big question.
So Tesla has just reduced the prices on their cars, the Model 3, which is the only one you can currently buy in Australia, and the Tesla is a significantly better vehicle than the Mini in terms of range, so how far you'll get from a charge. It's sort of, you know, you'd be looking at something like double the range, somewhere around that. It's a better car to drive in terms of the dynamics and so on, and it's also going to have more space and so on in the cabin. So that it comes back to a bit what I was touching on earlier in terms of an EV that started from the outset, was designed from the ground up as an electric car. They can maximise everything in there, whereas that Mini you're looking at, it's taken an existing car and they've replaced the oily bits with electric bits. So you can see those compromises in it. The ones, though, that I would probably stick on your radar ahead of, or potentially alongside the Tesla, would be two coming up, which are quite interesting. The Hyundai Ioniq 5 and the Kia EV6, which underneath, they're very similar cars. They share the same electronics and so on, but different styling outside. And they will be, I think, similar price, possibly more affordable than the Mini. And on paper, they look like a more complete vehicle than the Mini for sure. So it's... So, the Mini's fun. It looks the business. It's got all those Mini bits in it. It's got the retro styling and so on. But as an electric vehicle, it doesn't stack up nearly as well as some of the other ones on the market at the moment.
Okay. Kay says, my 2008 Mazda Neo Sport was written off. I'm 73. I don't want an expensive new car. There's quite a few used Mazda 3s. Yeah, Mazda 3 Maxes around, 2014 to 2016. Are these okay? I only do about 9,000 Ks a year.
Yeah, absolutely. And they would be somewhere, well, they'd probably be at the top of my list in terms of, if you're looking at a five or six year old small car.
Yep.
One of the advantages with the Mazdas from that era, they used to really pump them up with equipment. So they had more equipment than most of the rivals at the time. That's changed in recent years. Things like a Toyota Corolla, for example, now easily match them in terms of the standard features. But back then, they didn't stand up as well as in the Corollas and so on. Didn't stand up as well. So, absolutely. Mazda 3, you could do a heck of a lot worse than that. And,
okay.
With all of them, buy carefully. Look at how it's been treated and everything. But sure. You should step into a nice car.
Okay, don't we? Yes, go ahead. All right, Bruce from Newcastle. Hi, Bruce.
Yeah, hello.
G'day.
Yeah, hi. Toby, I was hoping I could get some information off you on imported from Japan Hiaces. I've got it. The requirement that I have is that I do a lot of surfing and camping, and I've had Hiaces before, and they've got very poor traction if you park them on grass, but I do like their reliability, and the Hiace has got plenty of room in it. Because I surf, so I have a surfboard and I like to camp in it, so I need a little bit of room. So these things that are coming into the country now, or not so much now, they've been coming in for some time, but they're turbo diesels with the 1KZ or KHZ motor in them, which I believe is one of the Prado engines, and they're four-wheel drive. And I just wondered whether you had any... They're turbocharged diesels, of course, and I was just wondering whether you had any comments to make about those. You can buy them for about 16,000 to 18,000, and they've got reasonably low kilometers, like in the order of 150,000 or so. I'd be curious about the spares situation, and I think you may have some trouble getting them insured. What do you say, Toby?
So, yeah, certainly you've touched on two of the main points there. Insurance can be an issue, but you'll find people to insure it, absolutely, but it's worth ringing around or hitting websites to get some quotes in terms of what they're likely to charge for something like that. The thing that can scare some insurance companies off is finding parts if the vehicle's involved in a crash or damaged in some way. In the past it's been a lot more difficult to try and find parts. These days, it's a lot easier, obviously, with the internet and so on. You can generally hook online and find someone who'll probably deliver them to your door pretty quickly. And obviously, a lot of the places that import them will also look after you with parts and so on. That said, there's still things to look out for. I mean, some of these cars that are imported from places like Japan may have had a crash that's been repaired. They're also going to have some things in the car, whether it's infotainment systems and so on, that may not necessarily match up with what we'd expect in Australia. So I'd be aware of all of that. Yes, you're picking up a cheap car, but there are going to be negatives, as I said, along the lines of those. So the other options to look at secondhand SUVs and so on in Australia, but once you're talking about 16 to 18 grand, you tend to have to go a bit older at the moment. I'd be a bit aware of that sort of stuff. Absolutely.
Yep. All right. Thanks, Bruce. Peter from the Blue Mountains. G'day, Peter.
Yeah. G'day, Phil. How are you?
Not bad.
Question for Toby. I was just wondering if in an electric vehicle, if a wind generator can be placed at the air intake for a vehicle, so that it drives, so that it can, as the vehicle is driven, it can recharge the battery. Is that at all possible?
It's definitely possible, absolutely. And I was actually reading up on this, I think just yesterday. There's a company in the States called Atlas, A-T-L-I-S, which makes these pretty hardcore-looking utes and off-roaders. And they had that, they've got that exact question on the FAQ section of their website. And they said they looked at it and they had a look at potentially doing it. But the reason they don't do it is they say that the aerodynamic drag penalty as a result of putting a wind generator on the front of the car actually takes you backwards in terms of efficiency. So you're not going to make enough electricity out of it to overcome the aerodynamic drag. That's something, you know, I mean, there's other things they can look at as well along those sorts of lines in terms of how to generate electricity on the run. The biggest way they all do it these days, obviously, is regenerative braking, so that when you hit the brake pedal, it often on a general...
You get the regenerative,
So you reverse the flow of the electrons in the electric motor and send it back into the motor. And that's where they get big gains. You can get some big gains out of that, and that's why EVs actually tend to use more fuel at, say, 110 on a freeway than they do around town, which is the opposite of what most other cars, a petrol or a diesel car, gets. Usually the petrol or diesel car is more efficient at 100 or 110 and you use more fuel around town, but EVs tend to be a little bit the opposite.
Okay. All right, Pete, thank you. Everyone's after the perpetual motion machine, aren't they? Trish, hello. What's up, Trish?
Oh, well, I'd like to ask Toby, please, Phil. I have a 2000 Holden Astra, and it needs replacing. It sort of conked out on me a few weeks ago, so I can't trust it. And I'm looking either at something that's similar, a smaller car, either a Kia Picanto or a Toyota Yaris. I'm just looking for some advice.
Are you looking new or secondhand?
Sorry?
Are you looking for a new car or a secondhand car?
Well, it's difficult. I mean, if the Kia Picanto is quite reasonable, so I suppose maybe a new car, but I realise it's going to take months to get a new car here. That's what I've been told. Is that right?
With some models, it's not an across the board thing. Certainly, some cars are in short supply at the moment, but it depends where you're looking. So so don't be put off purely by that's the short story. But first of all, great going getting 21 years out of a Holden Astra, because that era of Astra had quite a few issues, brake issues and other things like that. And certainly they were brilliant when they were new, but they could cause people a lot of hassles years after the fact. So well done on that. The challenge you're looking at in the end of the market you're looking at, that sort of previously sub $20,000 market, has sort of stepped up now. And a Yaris, for example, is sort of 25, 26 grand as a start price. And you can go up from that. But the ones to look at, so a Kia Picanto, yes, is good. You can also look at a Kia Rio, which is slightly bigger, but it's got a slightly bigger engine. So that's going to give you, it's going to feel a little bit more solid in terms of how it drives. Something like a Yaris, I'm not sure I'd be splashing out for a brand new Yaris. If you can find a second-hand one, potentially yes, but you'd want to make it fairly or only a year or two old, because before that they used to be a bit tight on things like safety equipment. And I think it was a four-speed auto on those second-hand, the older Yarises, and it was a pretty ordinary drivetrain. It didn't have much fluidity to it. Suzuki Swift would be a better bet. So a little Suzuki Swift is great buying, and you can get into those relatively affordably as well. And that's a car that's likely to just soldier on for a long time as well. And the other one to stick on the list would be a second-hand Mazda 2. So either a new Suzuki Swift or a second-hand Mazda 2 would be the top two of that selection, as I said, other than the Kia that you were already stuck on the shortlist as well.
All right, Trish.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much for that, Toby.
No worries. Thank you, Trish. Bye. 1-300-800-222. Angelo's in Wagga. G'day, Angelo.
Good evening, gentlemen. Yeah, so Toby, you had a question. I've driven about 5 Cal AVs. Obviously, that model now not available. I found them to be very reliable, just the right amount of gadgetry. What do you suggest that you would look at as a replacement for that the next time I change over?
It's a challenge. Did you have the V6 or the V8 in the
V6.
V6, okay. Look, I know a Holden, a traditional Holden buyer never would have looked sideways at a Toyota Camry, but the latest Toyota Camrys are really nice cars. They're surprisingly good. The performance on them is reasonable. So I'd certainly consider a Camry, and you can get some pretty good safety features and so on in them. You're not going to have quite as much grunt as you had in your V6, but if you buy something like the hybrid, you'll actually find that the grunt is where you need it more often. It's got that good sort of mid-range flexibility. So I'd stick that on the list. The other one to consider would be a Kia Stinger, which is sort of the traditional, the closest thing to a Commodore in terms of rear-wheel drive, good performance and so on. They do a four-cylinder and a V6. The V6 is by far the better bet in terms of the V6 twin turbo, terrific engine, a lot of grunt. But the four-cylinder is a little bit unloved, and on the used car market, you could probably pick one up reasonably nicely, potentially even on the new car market too, if the dealer's desperate to get rid of it. But a bit of a left fielder would be a Skoda Superb, is also a great car for the money. So it's they do all-wheel drive versions of that. They've got it's a very sure-footed car. It's got a European feel to it all. Volkswagen running gear underneath, and it's worth a look as well.
How does the ride on the Stinger compare? You know, in terms of
Yes, it's a performance car. But it's still relatively compliant in terms of suspension. It's set up sporty-ish, but it's not overly hard. And look, coming out of Calais, obviously Holden Calais, they used to get a slightly softer suspension tune than the SSs, the SS Commodores. And I think they found a really nice sweet spot in that with the Calais in terms of ride and handling, getting it both comfortable and decent around corners and so on. The Kia is sort of similar, probably not quite as well balanced in terms of the juggling those two opposing forces in it as the Holden used to do, but it's not far off it. It's still a really good car in terms of the in terms of that ride handling balance. Absolutely.
All right, Angela.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Angela. Bye bye. Fred is waiting on his. Are you waiting on the Corvette, Fred?
Yeah. Well, we spoke a few months ago, if you remember, and I was hoping to. They've bought them out in right-hand drive. They've produced a few hundred. Toby remembers. He knew all about it. And I was hoping to get mine in September. But now I know I've moved up the list, not even though it's back in January. So it'll be a 2022 model. So they've done a lot of things to it in those 2 years. There's one thing that certainly has changed. I think Toby said they started at $155,990. They're now $263,990. So there's a bit of a shock there, which hopefully has dropped a few people off the list and pushed them out further, because I'm so excited about this car. I can't wait. My wife is going insane because there's more to talk about with a Corvette than there is about anything else.
But when you say 263, you're going for the top of the range one, are you?
Oh, yeah, 3LT. That's exactly where it is, because I put the order in last year, so I've been waiting, about 7-10 months, and I've got another 7 to go, but it's worth waiting for. It's just a magical car, and as I think you said at the time, I used to look at it on the monitor, and it's true. It's as close as you get to it, but... it's just a magical motor vehicle. As you might have remembered, it's mid-engine, dry sump, all that sort of stuff. In those 2 years, they have increased it now to, there's a few technical changes, and it's not to 100, 2.6 seconds, which is a bit more than I get to the end of the street, but I won't be driving it like that, of course. I'm too old. What happened?
Have you got any parking, Fred, or you're on the street?
No, I'm at home. I just went to bed and I turned your shower and I thought, hello, there's the guys.
You just want some dirty talk about the Corvette, don't you, Fred? That's what you
want.
I still can't work out the 263. I mean, it's supposed to start at $160,000 plus on road costs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How are you spending 263?
What options are you putting on it? You're getting the carbon edition and all that, or no?
Carbon, yes.
Tick that box.
And it's red mist with camel coloured napper inside. 6.2 litre grunt. And it's just, it's a car that you'll wait all your life for. When you get to a certain age, you think, okay, let's do it. So it goes. So, right. But the 150 that you've got there, whether it's in your book or what have you, if you actually get in touch with General Motors Special Vehicle Dealer, because only so many of them have the car coming in, I've gone from 27th place to 26th to 20, and now I'm 6th in line. So that's always the first one in Queensland, if all goes well. But they have increased basically $100,000.
Okay.
Wow. It might be. Is it possible I can get your details and have a chat to you about it off here? Later on, because I'm interested to learn a bit more about that. Maybe Fred, do some digging on it.
Fred, can we put you on hold? I'll put you on hold. Just give your details to Anne, and can we just take Fred's details on line one, and we'll pass them. We'll pass them on, Toby. Lorraine, hello, Lorraine.
Oh, good evening.
Hello.
What I'm ringing about, we have a Mitsubishi Lancer that's 11 years old. It's done 91,000 kilometres, and we haven't had any problems with it at all. The only thing we noticed after having a Camry was the road noise. Now, we're thinking of replacing it with a Mitsubishi ASX, and we're wondering if you know if it has any road noise.
So I can't remember how the road noise on it compares with an 11-year-old Lancer, but what you're probably noticing there a bit is small cars, so the small Mitsubishi Lancer from that sort of era, one of the areas they used to save a bit of money and also save weight was by not putting too much sound deadening in them. So anyone who's driven a Mazda from roughly 2000 to 2010, those sort of earlier of the newer generation Mazdas, they had a heck of a lot of road noise as well. Now, Mazda's addressed that particularly in the last 5 or 6 years, but a lot of those cars had that as well. I don't remember an ASX being as bad as some of those cars, but what I would say is you can probably do a little bit better than an ASX. I hear what you're saying. You're happy with the Mitsubishi and it's caused you very few issues, but you could almost nominate any of those Japanese brands, whether it's Mazda or Toyota or Honda or whoever, Subaru, Suzuki. A lot of those are going to be similar in terms of lack of issues with ownership if you look after them. And the reality is that ASX has been around a long time now. It's I'm guessing 7 or 8 years old, something like that. It's had a fair few facelifts along the way. So I'd almost suggest that there are better options to look for in that segment. Things like, for example, a Mazda CX-30, a Nissan Juke, is also worth a look. And those cars, my money, have got more flair in terms of the interior. They certainly have a better driving experience, and they're fresher in terms of the equipment and so on in them. So it's, keep your eyes open. Don't just lock yourself into the ASX.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much for your help.
Thanks, Lorraine. Bye-bye. Charmaine, hello. Hi, Charmaine.
Hello, Phil.
Hi.
I just wanted to report in to you because I rang it 4 years ago to get some advice from from Will, actually, about which Toyota to buy to travel around the outback.
Oh, yeah.
Because I actually wanted a sports car and couldn't find a car that would go.
Yeah.
Anyway, I asked about a Camry or a Corolla or a RAV4, and he said any would do. So I bought the Corolla, it being looking the most sporty anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great fun to drive. And I don't know why you fellows never recommend the Corolla, because I found it amazing. But I've just driven it up to the Gulf of Carpentaria.
Yep.
And it went fantastic on all roads.
Where are you from? Where did you start out, Charmaine?
From Melbourne.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, 3,200 k's up there and 7,000.
Can't do that these days, can you? No one can leave anywhere.
<You're> Not at the moment. So, yes, I went in May. But it was just an amazing car. It drove really well and very comfortable on all sorts of road conditions.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to report in and put a plug in for the Corolla.
Yeah, cool, absolutely. And look, Corollas, yeah, they're fine. And look, I guess part of the reason I don't recommend them as much is fewer and fewer people are asking about those cars. I mean, I touched on it earlier in the show about, you know, Prado's now outsell Corollas. So those small cars generally have dropped off in terms of interest levels from buyers, and sales generally have dropped off as well. So, but yeah, look, Corolla, and I think probably, I'm trying to think when the current Corolla came out, but that's where they stepped it up quite significantly. What they did go backwards on a bit with the current Corolla, though, was rear seat space, so they and also boot space. So it went backwards a bit in that regard. But in just about every other area, it stepped up hugely. So, still good buying.
Yep, great. Thank
on you, Charmaine. Thank you.
Right-o, bye.
Thanks, and thanks for telling us about a road trip that lots of people just can't do anymore. Speaking of road trips in the outback, we better say something about the Land Cruiser, Toby. The 300. I know it's out, but when are we going to see it?
Well, look, we're expecting it quite late in the year. I would think, whether October, November, December, something like that.
Right.
We've seen it already overseas. Like they've released images and so on of it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of interest in that car, and as we've touched on previously, right. It's gone to a V6 twin turbo diesel engine, but you've got more power and more torque than the current V8. So it's stepping up massively in that regard as well. So I think Land Cruiser is going to be an interesting one.
Sure. David in Melbourne. Hi, David.
Hi, guys. I was telling you about my son's new second-hand Tesla.
Oh, yeah.
He's bought a Model S, the high-performance one, which is about half retail price. It's about 4 years old now.
Yeah.
But and I've got it for 2 weeks driving it around, and it is unbelievable. And it's completely made me reevaluate how good electric cars are, really.
Yeah. I think a lot of people realise that when they get in one, they think, wow, and this is something as an evaluator of cars, I'm often looking at things like performance and throttle response and smoothness and ease of driving and everything, and EVs just kick it out of the park in that regard. They're certainly a long way ahead. The thing that scares everyone off is, oh, am I going to get to the next charge? But once you've lived with one that's got 300 or 400 kilometres of range, you suddenly realise, hang on a minute, it's not a major issue because I can easily do what I need to during the day and get home.
That's right. This has got a 420K range. My son lives in the country and it automatically maps all the superchargers for you. So it just drives there on your behalf.
Yeah.
You can charge it up. You can install a good charger in your driveway as well. But it makes you realise even hybrid cars you've got to reevaluate. But without an internal combustion engine in it, there's no servicing, there's no fuel, there's no liquids, there's no exhaust pipes, there's no transmission, there's no fuel tank. It's just all space.
There are liquids, though, and there is some servicing. So you've got coolant. So you've got coolant for the battery packs. Almost all EVs, and Nissan Leaf doesn't have it, but almost all EVs have coolant flying through them for the for heating and cooling of the battery packs or keeping them at the right temperature, and that needs to be changed as you do. You change your coolant in your radiator and so on. So there isn't no servicing. There's certainly a lot less servicing than you've got on a petrol or a diesel car. Absolutely, and it's the chances of something going wrong with the electric motor are close to zero. It's the battery packs are the complex, expensive part of an electric car.
Mm.
Well, even secondhand, they give you a good warranty and just the accelerator. It's 0 to 100 in 2.1 seconds, and it's all effortless.
No, that one's not 2.1.
This is the E85. It's the high performance 400 kilowatt one, and it's got
that'd be around 4 seconds, something like that, 0 to 100, somewhere around there.
It's neck wrenching, absolutely neck wrenching.
Anyway, it's faster. Yeah. It's faster than you need.
For sure. It's very exciting. Yeah. Very exciting.
Okay. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay, David. Thank you. Yeah, for the tick. I know I've got a mate who's got a Tesla 3. Yeah. And thinks it's the best car that he's ever had. So they do. That's right. They're a different thing, aren't they? But a lot of people are very, very switched onto them. Pardon the pun. What have you been driving? You've been driving the Mazda BT50, Toby?
Yeah, the BT50 Thunder. So this is the, we talked about ute sales. It's the top end of the ute market that now accounts for a significant chunk of the sales. So Mazda's playing a bit harder on that with this one called the Thunder. So it's got your usual add-ons, things like wheel arch flares and so on. A really good light bar on the front, LED light bar. It's like daylight when you hit the headlights, so that's pretty cool. And different styling and so on in terms of the grille and stuff has been treated a bit differently, a bit of a different front bull bar and so on. So drives very much the same as a regular Mazda BT50, but they've stepped it up in terms of the aesthetics and making it a little bit more competent off-road with some of the tweaks and so on they've done. Not bad.
All right. Terrific. All right, Toby. Well, thanks for soldiering on for us tonight. It's been fantastic. And talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Look forward to it. Thanks, Phil.
Toby Hagan, editor of EV Central. Check that website out, evcentral.com.au, which is a great site for looking at the latest in electric car news, evaluations, tests, and all of that stuff. Toby will be back in a couple of weeks.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.